Well, I wonder what you were thinking as you heard Genesis chapter 3 read for us. It's not very appealing stuff, is it? It's the sort of chapter that we might be tempted to skip over. Why don't we focus on the good stuff instead? The life-affirming stuff. Perhaps you might tolerate hearing it read in church, but to dwell on it for any length of time just doesn't seem like the sort of thing we'd want to do instinctively. I've recently been enjoying reading books with my young son Isaac. And this book here is his favourite. But there is one page that he has no time for at all, and it's this page. A page where the illustrations go dark and scary. He wastes no time in turning the page to get back to all the happy pages again. But when you've lived a bit longer than Isaac has, you start to realise that those pages are some of the most important pages to pay attention to. And it's just like that with Genesis 3. We skip over this chapter at our peril. Without taking the time to understand Genesis chapter 3, we simply won't understand the world in which we live. We won't understand where things have gone wrong. And we won't understand what hope we can have of things being put right again. And perhaps more so than normal, many of us through this season have wanted to make sense of the mess of life. The frustrations, the disappointments, the grief, the endless cycle of history repeating itself, the same injustices happening again and again. Or perhaps we've simply given up trying to make sense of it. And instead we've opted for distraction or denial or detachment or despair. Sometimes when we're confronted by the mess and the brokenness of life, we just have to look away. Well, maybe living in a place like Wargrave helps us to escape a little from the harsh reality of life. But the family discord, the diagnosis, the disappointments are still close by and they find their way to us. So we need to look at this chapter to face up to life with all of its troubles, all of its brokenness, all of its disappointment and frustration. And we've got quite a few things to notice, so let's first orientate ourselves and then we'll dive into the chapter itself. So we're still in the Garden of Eden, where we've been for a couple of Sundays. The scene's been set. We've got God as creator, the giver of life. We've got Adam and Eve. He's commissioned them with a task to finish God's work of creation. Chapter 1, verse 28. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." They've been given a task, and they've been given their place in the creation order. Adam is required to work the ground, and there's partnership as Eve joins Adam. And then as we come to chapter 3, we're introduced to the serpent. Here's a new character in the story. And so we're given a bit of an introduction. We're told that this is a crafty animal. So we're to expect some deception and some scheming to follow. And notice the clear mention that this is an animal that God has made. So from within creation comes the twist. This isn't dualism, good and evil as equal forces battling it out. No, this is a creature rebelling against the Creator. And here comes the craftiness straight away. Did God really say you must not eat fruit from any tree in the garden? So that's our first thing to notice in Genesis chapter 3, to see that sin is deceptive. Casting doubt in Eve's mind, twisting God's words. They sound a bit like God's words, but they also make God out to be a mean and ungenerous oppressor. Well, Eve does a fairly good job at first of spotting the serpent's fake news. She remembers what God has really said in Genesis chapter 2, verse 16. You are free to eat from any tree in the garden. And earlier in chapter 2, we've seen that there are trees of many kinds, pleasing to the eye and good for food. God has actually been generous and has granted freedom. But the serpent makes God out to be an ungenerous oppressor who restricts freedom. Do you see how that's a twisting of the way that things have actually been set up? And Eve is right that there's a tree in the middle of the garden that they have been commanded not to eat from. But in her answer to the serpent, she includes an extra prohibition that isn't actually found in Genesis chapter 2. Maybe the serpent's venom is already at work in her, twisting her view of what God has and hasn't said. The serpent's second attempt is even bolder. Did you spot it in verse 4? It's a mocking reply to Eve's answer. You will not certainly die. And here we have the pattern for all temptation. The promise of exactly what we want, what we desire, but without any consequences. It's a mocking of what God has told us. The serpent is essentially saying, how stupid you are to believe what God has told you. And then comes perhaps the most enticing promise. The most enticing promise of all sin. The power of autonomy. The ability to redraw the lines between good and evil ourselves. So that what we want to do is always on the right side of the line. How enticing. But notice how in just 4 verses of this chapter, the entire order of creation has been turned on its head. In the first 2 chapters of Genesis, we have seen God as creator, the eternal king over all that he's made, and then mankind given a special role over creation. But here, we have a creature calling the shots, claiming that he knows better than God. And then Adam and Eve are encouraged to get one up on God as well. So we have creation over mankind who are standing in judgment over God. It's the created order upside down. A created thing dictating to Adam and Eve who are encouraged to grasp power from God. And then from verse 6 onwards, it unfolds. It unravels. Eve has been taken in by temptation. Her desire for a tasty, beautiful apple that promises wisdom is too great. She takes and eats, and then so does Adam. And then in verse 7, the effects of this trespass are immediate. Shame and a tragic fracturing of the close relationship that mankind had enjoyed with God in the garden. Maybe we know something of this in our own lives. How sin brings separation, secrecy, and shame. Adam and Eve hide from God in the garden. And then in verse 9, notice God's gracious and gentle questioning. Where are you? I'm sure he knows where they are. I'm sure he knows exactly what has happened. But he gives them the opportunity to explain, to come forward by themselves. God is seeking, and mankind is in hiding. That's different to what most people in our society think, isn't it? Most people assume that mankind is seeking, and God is hiding. But that's not the Bible's account. Ever since Genesis chapter 3, God has been seeking and mankind has been hiding. That's what it says in John chapter 1. To all who receive him, who believe in his name, he gives the right to become children of God. God comes looking for us, and all we need to do is receive him. Well, after shame comes blame. That's one of our tactics to avoid facing up to what we've done. You may have heard the joke, Adam blamed Eve blamed the snake, and the snake didn't have a leg to stand on. Well, it sums up verses 11 to 13 pretty well. But notice in verse 12 that Adam even has the audacity to blame God, the woman who you put here with me. Isn't it so easy for us to do that as well? To blame God for allowing the temptation to be there in the first place. But the responsibility for our actions lies ultimately with us, whatever the circumstances. So we've seen in verses 1 to 13, and summarised for us there in the final words of verse 13, that sin is deceptive. It's a distortion of the truth. Now briefly, in verses 14 to 19, we'll think about how Genesis chapter 3 helps us to see that sin has consequences. Here's the uncomfortable bit. God's judgment on what has happened. We see three curses that affect the three agents of the trespass. Firstly, the serpent is cursed. Then the attention turns to the human agents. Notice that whilst the curses are devastating, unlike the serpent, neither the man or the woman themselves are actually cursed. And the curses are not arbitrary either. They concern the roles that mankind have been given in the creation order, the responsibility they've been given that had now been affected by their rebellion. Mankind had been told to fill the earth, and so the rebellion brings a curse on childbearing. Mankind had been given a special interdependent relationship with one another, Eve as Adam's helper. But this is now affected by that rebellion also. The struggle between the sexes, the abuse of power, the struggle for power, all an effect of this rebellion. What should have been a harmonious and mutually beneficial partnership becomes a struggle. Then the ground is cursed. The very thing that mankind has been asked to rule over and to tend has now been cursed. Food will no longer come as easily as it did in the garden. And there's dust. Dust will now be the theme of all human life. The dust of death will be over everything. A thin layer affecting every part of creation. Everything from chapter 2 onwards is still there, but the experience will be different. Mankind's relationship with one another will be affected, and mankind's relationship with creation affected also. It's a tragic picture, and it explains so much about the world in which we live. These are truths that are almost universally accepted, that the world in which we live is beautiful and good, but also broken. There are brochures and advertisements that sell us the good life, but the reality is always affected by brokenness in some way. The holiday in a beautiful spot that is spoilt by arguments and friction, or food poisoning, or a stolen handbag. Beautiful and good, but also broken. We are reminded each and every day that we live in a fallen world, marred by human sin and rebellion against its creator. But this passage isn't all doom and gloom. There are some remarkable glimmers of hope. Look back at verse 15. In the midst of the serpent being cursed comes a slightly puzzling promise that he, a descendant of the woman, will crush the serpent's head and the serpent will strike his heel. I.e., someday, in the future, there will be a decisive encounter between the serpent and one of Eve's offspring. And in this moment, the serpent will be defeated once and for all. But not before the serpent is able to strike a fatal blow himself. It's pointing forward to a day in the future where the wrong will be made right. So as we read the rest of the Bible, we're to be on the lookout for this serpent crusher who will die himself as he defeats the serpent. And then look down at verses 20 and 21. Straight after the curses, we see Adam naming Eve. It'll be easy to miss, but her name is significant. Mother of all the living. It's not the end of the story. There is hope as Adam and Eve look to the future. And verse 21, the Lord God makes garments of skin to clothe Adam and Eve in their nakedness, to remove their shame, even after all that has happened. So Genesis 3 helps us see sin as a distortion of God's goodness, helps us to see how all of creation is broken and affected, and helps us to see how God's grace is cause for hope. Well, there are lots of implications from this passage. We need to see sin for the deception and distortion that it is. We need to see the dangers of doubting God's word, doubting his character, his judgment. We need to see the ugliness of our rebellion against him. And we need to see that sin has serious consequences. But as we're in the season of creation tide and thinking particularly about our relationship to creation, here are some brief implications focused on that. First of all, I think this chapter helps us to see that environmental problems are grounded in believing the foolish lie that we can have whatever we desire without any negative consequences. That was a mistake that Eve made, and it applies to our relationship with the environment. So we know, in the midst of environmental problems, that the root cause isn't policy or consumerism. No, it's sin, human sin. It's sin in each of us. Gus Speth, an academic, a scientist and a policy advisor, has written this. I used to think the top global environmental problems were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse and climate change. I thought that with 30 years of good science, we could address those problems. But I was wrong. The top environmental problems are selfishness, greed, and apathy. And to deal with these, we need a spiritual and cultural transformation. And we scientists don't know how to do that. So, as Christians, thinking about environmental problems, we have more of the story and we have more of the solution. The other thing we see, I think, from this passage when we think about our relationship with the environment is that blaming others isn't good enough. That's what we saw in the garden, wasn't it? Adam blaming Eve, Eve blaming the serpent, even blaming God. But blaming others isn't good enough. We each have responsibility for our actions. Each of us, and I very much include myself in this, need to take responsibility for what God has called us to as his stewards, his vice-regents of the world that he's committed to our care. We know that it's the poorest who will suffer if we don't take action. And thirdly and finally, we do not face the future without hope. We saw the hope embedded in this chapter, as tragic as it is. And as Christians, we have hope for the future too. And in fact, it's precisely because we have hope that we will strive to take our responsibility seriously. If we had no hope, we'd just give up and stop caring, and that apathy would set in. No, because we have hope, we can take action.